lips to his audience. What he said could not fail to find appeal. The build-up of the armed forces was the most important premise to the central aim of regaining political power. General conscription had to be brought back. But before that, the state leadership had to see to it that all traces of pacifism, Marxism, and Bolshevism were eradicated from those eligible for military service. The armed forces, the most important institution in the state, must be kept out of politics and above party. The internal struggle was not its concern and could be left to the organizations of the Nazi movement. Preparations for the build-up of the armed forces had to take place without delay. This period was the most dangerous, and Hitler held out the possibility of a preventive strike from France, probably together with its allies in the East. "How should political power, once won, be used?" he asked. It was still too early to say. Perhaps the attainment of new export possibilities should be the goal, he hinted. But since earlier in the speech he had already dismissed the notion of increasing exports as the solution to Germany's problems, this could not be taken by his audience as a favored suggestion. Perhaps, and probably better, conquest of new living space in the East and its ruthless Germanization was his alternative. The officers present could have been left in no doubt that this was Hitler's preference. Hitler had not put forward a plan for war to his generals, nor had he outlined a stage-by-stage program for the acquisition of living space. In broad terms, he had restated the fixed ideas he had held to since the mid-1920s at the latest. A war for living space in the East was certainly implicit in what he was saying. But few had taken his earlier utterances and writings as a serious statement of intent, and few of the generals now regarded living space as more than a loose metaphor for expansionism, of which they did not disapprove. Hitler's sole aim at Hammerstein's had been to woo the officers and ensure army support. He largely succeeded. The military leader's reaction to the speech was mixed. General Ludwig Beck later claimed he had immediately forgotten its content, an indication, if true, that he was unconcerned by what Hitler had to say. Others, such as Werner von Fritsch, Friedrich Fromm, and Eugen Ott, were apparently worried initially by what they heard. Erich Freiherr von dem Büsche-Ippenberg thought Hitler spoke nonsense for an hour before coming on to the matters concerning the army. Generalleutnant Wilhelm Ritter von Leib commented acidly that a businessman with a good product did not need to shout about it like a market seller. But there was no opposition to what Hitler had said, and many of those present, as Admiral Erich Raeder later commented, found Hitler's speech extraordinarily satisfying. This was hardly surprising. However disdainful they were of the vulgar and loud-mouthed social upstart, the prospect he held out of restoring the power of the army as the basis for expansionism and German dominance accorded with aims laid down by the army leadership, even in what they had seen as the dark days of fulfillment policy in the mid-1920s. And Hitler's promises to remove the army from internal politics, place it above the party, and to build up the armed forces as the pillar of a militarized nation were music to the ears of the generals, according completely with what Blomberg had told group and army district commanders earlier in the day. Hitler was, in effect, protecting the army from any possible involvement in a civil war, a danger taken most seriously in late 1932. From the point of view of the army leadership, rearmament and rebuilding the armed forces, predicated on removal of the shackles of Versailles, as the vehicle for restoring Germany's great power status through expansion, accepting the risk of war, had remained unbroken aims throughout the 1920s and had been restated with new urgency towards the end of the decade. They went hand in hand with the axiom that the officer caste, which was in reality now greatly altered, less feudal, more professionally modern, youthful, and bourgeois, would regain the status and power in the state that it had traditionally wielded before the revolution, but which had been threatened and partially undermined by Marxism and democracy. Whatever the general's skepticism about Hitler, the mass support he commanded offered the prospect of these aims now being fulfilled. While their aims were not identical, it meant that there was a significant overlap in what Hitler and the army leadership wanted. The Pact of 1933 was founded on this partial identity. The strong man in Blomberg's ministry, his chief of the ministerial office, Colonel Walter von Reichenau, bright, ambitious, progressive, in his contempt for class-ridden, aristocratic and bourgeois conservatism, and long a National Socialist sympathizer, was sure of how the army should react to what Hitler offered. "Into the new state and uphold there the position due to us," he is reported to have stated. "Never before had the armed forces been so identical with the state," he went on, indicating the clear aim, if not the full reality of the position, at the very beginning of the Third Reich. The real meaning of keeping the army out of politics was also made plain by Reichenau when, in the midst of Göring's unleashed police terror against the left in Prussia, he remarked at a meeting of army commanders, "It has to be recognized that we are in a revolution. What is rotten in the state has to go, and that can only happen through terror. The party will ruthlessly proceed against Marxism. Task of the armed forces, stand at ease. No support if those persecuted seek refuge with the troops." Some of those present were concerned at what they heard, but the message got through and was passed on. Only one of the officers there protested and lost his command as a consequence. Though not, for the most part, as actively sympathetic towards National Socialism as was Reichenau, the leaders of the army which had blocked by force Hitler's attempt to seize power in 1923 had now, within days of his appointment as Chancellor, placed the most powerful institution in the state at his disposal. Hitler, for his part, lost no time in making plain to the cabinet that military spending was to be given absolute priority. During a discussion in cabinet on the 8th of February on the financial implications of building a dam in Upper Silesia, he intervened to tell his cabinet colleagues that the next 5 years must be devoted to the restoration of the defense capacity, die der Wehrhaftmachung of the German people. Every state-funded work creation scheme had to be judged with regard to their necessity for this end. The idea must always and everywhere be placed in the foreground. At a meeting the next day of the Committee for Work Creation to deal with the expenditure envisaged of the 500 million Reichmark available under the revamped immediate program for work creation, which Reichskommissar Gerecke had prepared for the Schleicher administration, Blomberg expressed his readiness to accept for rearmament purposes the 50 million RM assigned to him by the finance minister, while the newly created Reich Commissary for Air Travel was allocated 42.3 million RM in 1933 out of 127 million RM over a three-year period. Hitler could not contain his impatience. He referred to his comments of the previous day on the absolute priority for rearmaments and the need to assess all public spending on the immediate program in that light. "For Germany's rearmament," the Reich Chancellor continued, according to the minutes of the meeting, "billions, Milliardenbeträge are necessary. The sum of 127 million RM for aviation purposes was the minimum that one could consider at all. Germany's future depended exclusively and solely on rebuilding the armed forces. All other expenditure had to be subordinated to the task of rearmament. He could only be satisfied with the petty funds requested by the Defense Ministry on the grounds that the tempo of rearmament could not be more sharply accelerated during the coming year. At any rate, he took the view that in any future clash between demands of the armed forces and demands for other purposes, the interest of the armed forces had, whatever the circumstances, to take precedence. The provision of funds from the immediate program had also to be decided on this understanding. He viewed the combating of unemployment through the provision of public orders as the most suitable means of aid. The 500 million program was the greatest of its kind and specially suited to be placed at the service of the interests of rearmament. It best allowed the camouflage of works for improving the defense of the country. It was necessary to place special weight on this camouflage in the immediate future, since he was convinced that the period between the theoretical recognition of equal military rights of Germany and the reattainment of a certain level of armament would be the most difficult and most dangerous one. Only when Germany had rearmed to such a level that it was capable of alliance with another power, if need be also against France, would the main difficulties of rearmament have been overcome." These early meetings, within days of Hitler becoming Chancellor, were crucial in determining the primacy of rearmament. They were also typical of the way Hitler operated and of the way his power was exercised. Keen though Blomberg and the Reichswehr leadership were to profit from the radically different approach of the new Chancellor to armament spending, there were practical limitations, financial, organizational, and not least those of international restrictions while the disarmament talks continued, preventing the early stages of rearmament being pushed through as rapidly as Hitler wanted. But where Blomberg was content at first to work for expansion within the realms of the possible, Hitler thought in different, initially quite unrealistic, dimensions. He offered no concrete measures, but his dogmatic assertion of absolute primacy for rearmament, opposed or contradicted by not a single minister, set new ground rules for action. It changed the concept of the Gedecke program for work creation entirely, turning it into a framework for rearmament. It provided, whatever the early practical limits on the scope of rearmament, immediate opportunities for new planning and rebuilding within the armed forces. It prompted, by the beginning of April, the second armaments program, with funding provided outside the state budget and placed in the hands of the army itself. With Hjalmar Schacht succeeding Hans Luther in March as president of the Reichsbank, Hitler found the person he needed to mastermind the secret and unlimited funding of rearmament. Where the Reichswehr budget had on average been 700 to 800 million RM a year, Schacht, through the device of MIFO bills, a disguised discounting of government bills by the Reichsbank, was soon able to guarantee to the Reichswehr the fantastic sum of 35 billion RM over an 8-year period. Given this backing, after a sluggish start, the rearmament program took off stratospherically in 1934. The result, as Schacht later acknowledged, was an inevitable collision between armaments and consumer spending, which would eventually lead to major economic difficulties. These were to surface in the first substantial economic impasse of 1935-6 that culminated in the 4-year plan. But since that plan underlined and reaffirmed the absolute primacy of rearmament, the problem could only deepen in the remaining peacetime years and not be resolved outside war. The ruination of state finances was implicit in the decision, taken on political and ideological grounds at the very outset of Hitler's chancellorship, to make unlimited funding available for rearmament, whatever the consequences for the economy. Though war was not actually planned in February 1933, the rearmament policy then adopted tilted the economy in a direction which could only be remedied either by a re-entry into the international economy or by conquest and domination attained through the gamble of war. Hitler had never made a secret of which option he would prefer. The decision to give absolute priority to rearmament was the basis of the pact, resting on mutual benefit between Hitler and the army, which, though frequently troubled, was a key foundation of the Third Reich. Hitler established the parameters in February 1933, but these were no more than the expression of the entente he had entered into with Blomberg on becoming Chancellor. The new policy was possible because Hitler had bound himself to the interests of the most powerful institution in the land. The army leaders, for their part, had their interests served because they had bound themselves, in their eyes, to a political front man who could nationalize the masses and restore the army to its rightful power position in the state. What they had not reckoned with was that within 5 years, the traditional power elite of the officer corps would be transformed into a mere functional elite serving a political master who was taking it into uncharted territory. 2. In the first weeks of his chancellorship, Hitler took steps to bring not just the big battalions of the army leadership behind the new regime, but also the major organizations of economic leaders. Landholders needed little persuasion. Their main organization, the Reich Agrarian League, Reichslandbund, dominated by East Elbian estate owners, had been strongly pro-Nazi before Hitler became Chancellor. Hitler left agrarian policy in its initial stage to his German national coalition partner, Hugenberg. Early measures taken in February to defend indebted farm property against creditors and to protect agricultural produce by imposing higher import duties and provide support for grain prices ensured that the agrarians were not disappointed. With Hugenberg at the Economics Ministry, their interests seemed certain to be well looked after. Tensions between agrarians and industrialists over the vexed issue of protection of agriculture had existed since the 1890s. The new favoritism shown to agriculture seemed destined to sour relations with big business. The initial skepticism, hesitancy, and misgivings of most business leaders immediately following Hitler's accession to the chancellorship were not dispelled overnight. There was still considerable disquiet in the business community when Gustav Krupp von Bohlen und Halbach, head of the mighty Krupp Iron and Steel Concern and chairman of the Reich Association of German Industry, and other leading industrialists received invitations to a meeting at Göring's official residence on the 20th of February, at which Hitler would outline his economic policy. Krupp, up to then critical of Hitler, went to the meeting prepared, as he had done at meetings with previous chancellors, to speak up for industry. In particular, he intended to stress the need for export-led growth and to underline the damaging consequences of protectionism in favor of agriculture. In the event, he could make neither point. The businessmen were kept waiting by Göring and had to wait even longer till Hitler appeared. They were then treated to a classic Hitler monologue. In a speech lasting an hour and a half, he barely touched on economic matters except in the most general sense. He assuaged his business audience, as he had done on earlier occasions, by upholding private property and individual enterprise and by denying rumors of planned radical experimentation in the economy. The rest was largely a restatement of his views on the subordination of the economy to politics, the need to eradicate Marxism, restore inner strength and unity, and thus be in a position to face external enemies. The coming election marked a final chance to reject communism by the ballot box. If that did not happen, force, he darkly hinted, would be used. It was a fight to the death between the nation and communism, a struggle that would decide Germany's fate for the next century. When Hitler had finished, Krupp felt in no position to deliver his prepared speech. He merely improvised a few words of thanks and added some general remarks about a strong state serving the well-being of the country. At this point, Hitler left. The hidden agenda of the meeting became clear once Göring started speaking. He repeated Hitler's assurances that economic experiments need not be feared and that the balance of power would not be altered by the coming election, to be the last for perhaps 100 years. But the election, he claimed, was nonetheless crucial, and those not in the forefront of the political battle had a responsibility to make financial sacrifices. Once Göring too had left, Schlacht bade those present to visit the cash till. 3 million marks were pledged and within weeks delivered. With this donation, big business was helping consolidate Hitler's rule. But the offering was less one of enthusiastic backing than of political extortion. Despite their financial support, industrialists continued at first to look with a wary eye at the new regime. Some drew satisfaction from Hitler's vague expression of support for export trade and commitment to currency stability in his speech on the 23rd of March, and the Reich Association correspondingly voiced its support for the new government. But its members were already realizing that their position was also not left untouched by the changes sweeping over Germany. In early April, Krupp capitulated to Nazi pressure to replace the Reich Association by a new Nazified body. He also agreed to the dismissal of Jewish employees and the removal of all Jewish businessmen from representative positions in commerce and industry. The following month, the once mighty association dissolved itself and was replaced by the Nazified Reich Estate of German Industry, Reichsstand der Deutschen Industrie. Alongside such pressure, business recovery, high profits, secure private property, apart from that of Jewish businessmen, the crushing of Marxism, and the subduing of labor saw big business increasingly content to adjust to full collaboration with the new regime, whatever the irksome bureaucratic controls imposed on it. Hitler's style, as the industrialists experienced on the 20th of February, was certainly different to that of his predecessors in the Chancellor's office. His views on the economy were also unconventional. He was wholly ignorant of any formal understanding of the principles of economics. For him, as he stated to the industrialists, economics was of secondary importance, entirely subordinated to politics. His crude social Darwinism dictated his approach to the economy as it did his entire political worldview. Since struggle among nations would be decisive for future survival, Germany's economy had to be subordinated to the preparation, then carrying out, of this struggle. That meant that liberal ideas of economic competition had to be replaced by the subjection of the economy to the dictates of the national interest. Similarly, any socialist ideas in the Nazi program had to follow the same dictates. Hitler was never a socialist, but although he upheld private property, individual entrepreneurship, and economic competition, and disapproved of trade unions and workers' interference in the freedom of owners and managers to run their concerns, the state, not the market, would determine the shape of economic development. Capitalism was therefore left in place. But in operation, it was turned into an adjunct of the state. There is little point in inventing terms to describe such an economic system. Neither state capitalism nor a third way between capitalism and socialism suffices. Certainly Hitler entertained notions of a prosperous German society in which old class privileges had disappeared, exploiting the benefits of modern technology and a higher standard of living. But he thought essentially in terms of race, not class, of conquest, not economic modernization. Everything was consistently predicated on war to establish dominion. The new society in Germany would come about through struggle, its high standard of living on the backs of the slavery of conquered peoples. It was an imperialist concept from the 19th century, adapted to the technological potential of the 20th. Lacking, as he did, a grasp of even the rudiments of economic theory, Hitler can scarcely be regarded as an economic innovator. The extraordinary economic recovery that rapidly formed an essential component of the Führer myth was not of Hitler's making. He showed no initial interest in the work creation plans eagerly developed by civil servants in the Labour Ministry. With Schacht at this stage skeptical, Hugenberg opposed, Selter taking little initiative, and industry hostile, Hitler did nothing to further the work creation schemes before the end of May. By then, they'd been taken up by the State Secretary in the Finance Ministry, Fritz Reinhardt, and put forward as a program for action. Even at this stage, Hitler remained hesitant and had to be convinced that the program would not lead to renewed inflation. Wilhelm Lautenbach, a senior civil servant in the Economics Ministry, whose own full-scale program had had no chance of implementation under Brüning in 1931, persuaded him that, though he was the most powerful man in Germany, even he could not produce inflation in the prevailing economic circumstances. Finally, on the 31st of May, Hitler summoned ministers and economic experts to the Reich Chancellery and heard that all but Hugenberg were in favor of the Reinhardt program. The following day, the law for reduction of unemployment was announced. Within a month or so, Schacht's early skepticism had turned into enthusiasm. Through the device of exchange bills underwritten by the government, an idea earlier developed under Papen by Lautenbach, and the forerunner of the MEFO bills, soon to be introduced as a way of funding the early stages of rearmament, Schacht now conjured up the necessary short-term credits. The rest was largely the work of bankers, civil servants, planners, and industrialists. As we have noted, Hitler saw the work creation program, which simply extended the earlier schemes devised under Papen and Schleicher, merely in the context of rearmament plans. Otherwise, his main interest was in its propaganda value. And indeed, as public works schemes initially, then increasingly rearmament, began to pull Germany out of recession and wipe away mass unemployment more quickly than any forecasters had dared speculate, Hitler garnered the full propaganda benefit. But indirectly, Hitler did make a significant contribution to the economic recovery by reconstituting the political framework for business activity and by the image of national renewal that he represented. The ruthless assault on Marxism and reordering of industrial relations which he presided over, the work creation program that he eventually backed, and the total priority for rearmament laid down at the outset helped to shape a climate in which economic recovery already starting as he took office as Chancellor, could gather pace. And in one area, at least, he provided a direct stimulus to recovery in a key branch of industry, motor car manufacturing. Hitler's propaganda instinct, not his economic know-how, led him towards an initiative that both assisted the recovery of the economy, which was beginning to take place anyway, and caught the public imagination. On the 11th of February, a few days before his meeting with the industrialists, Hitler had sought out the opportunity to deliver, instead of Reich President Hindenburg, who was unwell, the opening address at the International Automobile and Motorcycle Exhibition on the Kaiserdamm in Berlin. That the German Chancellor should make the speech was itself a novelty. This alone caused a stir. The assembled leaders of the car industry were delighted. They were even more delighted when they heard Hitler elevate car manufacture to the position of the most important industry of the future and promise a program including gradual tax relief for the industry and the implementation of a generous plan for road building. If living standards had previously been weighed against kilometers of railway track, they would in future be measured against kilometers of roads. These were great tasks which also belonged to the construction program of the German economy, Hitler declared. The speech was later stylized by Nazi propaganda as the turning point in the history of German motorization. It marked the beginning of the Autobahn Builder part of the Führer myth. Hitler had in fact offered no specific program for the car industry, merely the prospect of one. The ideas for tax relief for the industry had not surprisingly come from the car manufacturers themselves. The tax reductions, actually implemented in spring 1933, did not represent a preconceived Nazi motorization program, but were part of a wider framework of measures to stimulate the economy. What road building plans were in Hitler's mind were not made clear in his speech. In all likelihood, they were those that the Munich road engineer Fritz Todt had outlined in a brief memorandum composed in December 1932 and sent shortly afterwards to Hitler, arguing for the construction of 5,000 to 6,000 kilometers of motorway to be built within the framework of a national socialist construction program. It was conceived on a scale that could not rely on private companies, but had to have state planning and control. Moreover, Todt envisaged his scheme needing up to 600,000 unemployed workers, some 10% of the total number of unemployed, and thus contributing to the combating of unemployment. Todt himself was, in fact, no outright innovator in his motorization schemes. Autostradas were already being built in fascist Italy, and Todt was taking up and greatly expanding ideas for a north-south autobahn of 881 kilometers advanced in the 1920s by the clumsily entitled Association for the Preparation of the Motorway, Autostrasse, Hansestädte, Frankfurt, Basel, Hafraba for short. But Hitler was impressed, not least at the grandiosity of Todt's scheme and its implications for reducing unemployment. It made good propaganda in the election campaign. Even so, the significance of Hitler's speech on the 11th of February should not be underrated. It sent positive signals to car manufacturers. They were struck by the new Chancellor, whose long-standing fascination for the motor car and his memory for detail of construction types and figures meant he sounded not only sympathetic but knowledgeable to the car bosses. The Völkischer Beobachter, exploiting the propaganda potential of Hitler's speech, immediately opened up to its readers the prospect of car ownership. Not a social elite with its Rolls-Royces, but the mass of the people with their people's car. Volksauto was the alluring prospect. It was an idea, a car for every man, at a price of no more than 1,000 Reichmarks, that Hitler, with his eye on propaganda, more than the automobile market, was already advancing early in 1933. In the weeks following his speech, there were already notable signs that the car industry was picking up. More than twice as many four-wheeled vehicles were produced in the second quarter of 1933 compared with the same period in the previous year. The removal of car license tax for vehicles registered after the 31st of March gave the industry a further boost. The beginnings of recovery for the automobile industry had spin-off effects for factories producing component parts and for the metal industry. The recovery was not part of a well-conceived program on Hitler's part. Nor can it be wholly or even mainly attributed to his speech. Much of it would have happened anyway once the slump had begun to give way to cyclical recovery. It remains the case, however, that the car manufacturers were still gloomy about their prospects before Hitler spoke. Hitler, whatever importance he had attached to the propaganda effect of his speech, had given the right signals to the industry. Car manufacturers, and others with a vested interest, lost no time in interpreting the signals to their own advantage and to the advantage of the regime. Unsolicited, the business manager of Hafraba provided Hitler already in March with detailed plans for a stretch of motorway in the Main-Neckar Valley. Hitler took up the plan with great enthusiasm, called it a gigantic idea which would open up a new epoch, and declared his readiness to ensure its implementation. After the gigantic program of road building he announced on the 1st of May had met substantial obstacles in the Transport Ministry, backed by the German railways, the Reichsbahn, which argued that the ordinary road network should first be improved and indicated principled doubts about the virtues of a motorway program, Hitler insisted that the enterprise Reich Motorways, Unternehmen Reichsautobahnen, be carried through. This was eventually placed at the end of June in the hands of Fritz Todt as General Inspector for German Roadways, Generalinspektor für das Deutsche Straßenwesen. Further objections to Todt's new powers raised by Interior Minister Frick and Transport Minister Ernst Rubenach were swept aside by Hitler. By the end of November, Todt had been given wide-ranging powers, answering only to Hitler himself in the road construction program, and was provided by Reichsbank President Schacht with extensive funding credit. In the stimulus to the car trade and the building of the motorways, areas which, inspired by the American model, had great popular appeal and appeared to symbolize both the leap forward into an exciting technological modern era and the new Germany now standing on its own feet again, Hitler had made a decisive contribution. Three. By the time Hitler addressed the leaders of the automobile industry on the 11th of February, the Reichstag election campaign was underway. Hitler had opened it the previous evening with his first speech in the Sportpalast since becoming Chancellor. The enormous hall was packed to the rafters. With the mass media now at his disposal, the speech was carried live on radio to the whole country. Under great banners attacking Marxism, Goebbels set the scene in graphic detail for radio listeners, numbering, he claimed, as many as 20 million. Skillfully, he built up the expectations of the massive radio audience. "I ask you to let your fantasy take hold," the propaganda minister told his listeners. "Imagine this enormous building, down below a huge stalls arena, flanked with side aisles, the circle, the upper circle, all one mass of people. You can't recognize individuals. You see only shouts and choruses of voices rise up. People, 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 a mass of people. You can hear out of the masses the cries, 'Germany arise,' ring out. How shouts resound of Heil to the leader of the movement, to the Reich Chancellor, Adolf Hitler. The SA leader, Standartenführer Voss, now gives the signal for the entry of the flags and standards. Down there, from the end of the Sportpalast, the four Berlin standards are moved, followed by the hundreds of Berlin party banners. The German anthem sounds out and is sung. Amid the tones of the German anthem, the flags are borne through the wide hall. The entire mass is rapturously singing the German anthem. The Sportpalast offers a wonderful, imposing picture of the mass demonstration. The people stand and wait and sing with raised hands. You see only people, people, people. All around, the galleries are decked with swastika flags. The mood intensifies. The expectancy is full of tension. Any moment, the Reich Chancellor can arrive." Then Hitler came. A crescendo of shouts of Heil and rapturous cheering could be heard over Goebbels's broadcast. "You can hear it," the propaganda minister exulted. "The Führer has arrived." Hitler began quietly, almost hesitantly. For 14 years, the Weimar parties had ruined Germany. Rebuilding the country had to begin from the bottom. He promised a government that would not lie to and swindle the people as Weimar governments had done. Rebuilding could only be done by the people itself, by its own efforts, by its will, without any help from outside. Not class theories, but eternal laws would be the basis of the recovery. The struggle to sustain the German people's existence was the goal, and only strength would bring world peace. He raised the tempo. Parties of class division would be destroyed. Never, never will I depart from the task of eradicating from Germany Marxism and its accompaniments, he declared. One must be the victor here, either Marxism or the German people, and Germany will be victorious. National unity, resting on the German peasant and the German worker, restored to the national community, would be the basis of the future society. The value of personality, the creative strength of the individual, would be upheld. All manifestations of a parliamentary democratic system would be combated. The end of corruption in public life would go hand in hand with a restoration of German honour. Not least, young people would have instilled in them the great traditions of the German past. It was, he declared, a program of national revival, Wiedererebung. In all areas of life, intolerant towards anyone who sins against the nation, brother and friend to anyone willing to fight alongside for the resurrection of his people, of our nation. Hitler reached the rhetorical climax of his speech. German people, give us 4 years, then judge and sentence us. German people, give us 4 years, and I swear that as we and I entered into this office, I will then be willing to go. The pathos of his finale included an adaptation of the ending of the Our Father in its Protestant form. I can't free myself from belief in my people, can't get away from the conviction that this nation will once again arise, can't distance myself from the love of this, my people, and hold as firm as a rock to the conviction that sometime the hour will come when the millions who today hate us will stand behind us and with us will welcome what has been created together, struggled for under difficulty, attained at cost, the new German Reich of greatness and honour and strength and glory and justice. Amen. A fantastic speech, Goebbels called it, wholly against Marxism. At the end, great pathos. Amen, that has force and strikes home. It was indeed a powerful piece of rhetoric, but it was little more than that. The program offered nothing concrete other than the showdown with Marxism. National resurrection, to be brought about through will, strength, and unity, was what it amounted to. Jews were not mentioned. For all nationalists, not just for Nazis, the sentiments Hitler expressed could not fail to find appeal. Exactly the right mixture for his listeners. Brutality, threats, display of strength, then again humility before the often cited Almighty. The masses in the Sportpalast go into a frenzy, commented one of the 20 million or so radio listeners, a cultured member of the Leipzig bourgeoisie, unsympathetic to the Nazis. The man grows visibly through the task which has fallen on him, he remarked. For another, listening to his speech over the radio, the Hamburg middle-class nationalist, not Nazi, Luise Surmitz, Hitler's castigation of the dirt of these dreadful 14 years was what we felt. Not a speaker, but leader of genius, was how she described him. The accompaniment to the campaign, during which Hitler once more was tireless in his propaganda efforts, speaking to huge audiences in numerous cities, was a wave of unparalleled state-sponsored terror and repression against political opponents in states under Nazi control. Above all, this was the case in the huge state of Prussia, which had already come under Reich control in the Papen takeover of the 20th of July 1932. The orchestrator here was the commissary Prussian Minister of the Interior, Hermann Göring. Under his aegis, heads of the Prussian police and administration were cleansed, following the first purges after the Papen coup, of the remainder of those who might prove obstacles in the new wind of change that was blowing. Göring provided their successors with verbal instructions in unmistakably blunt language as to what he expected of police and administration during the election campaign. And in a written decree of the 17th of February, he ordered the police to work together with the national associations of SA, SS, and Stahlhelm, support national propaganda with all their strength, and combat the actions of organizations hostile to the state with all the force at their disposal, where necessary, making ruthless use of firearms. He added that policemen using firearms would, whatever the consequences, be backed by him. Those failing in their duty out of a false sense of consideration had, on the contrary, to expect disciplinary action. Unsurprisingly, in such a climate, the violence unleashed by Nazi terror bands against their opponents and against Jewish victims was uncontrolled. This was especially the case once the SA, SS, and Stahlhelm had been brought in on the 22nd of February as auxiliary police on the pretext of an alleged increase in left radical violence. Intimidation was massive. Communists were particularly savagely repressed. Individuals were brutally beaten, tortured, seriously wounded, or killed with total impunity. Communist meetings and demonstrations were banned in Prussia and in other states under Nazi control, as were their newspapers. Bans, too, on organs of the SPD and restrictions on reporting imposed on other newspapers effectively muzzled the press, even when the bans were successfully challenged in the courts as illegal and the newspapers reinstated. During this first orgy of state violence, Hitler played the moderate. His acting ability was undiminished. He gave the cabinet the impression that radical elements in the movement were disobeying his orders, but that he would bring them under control, and asked for patience to allow him to discipline the sections of the party that had got out of hand. We all agreed that there was no reason to doubt Hitler's intentions, and hoped that experience in the cabinet would have a beneficial effect on him, recalled Papen. When the Zentrum, which Hitler knew he might still need on his side, protested to Hindenburg and Papen at the unbelievable conditions, Hitler put out a party proclamation denouncing provocatory elements who had broken up Zentrum meetings and ordering extreme discipline. All the energies of the campaign had to be directed against Marxism, he added. In actual fact, the violence directed at the Zentrum had been in no small measure attributable to Hitler's own tirade against the head of the Zentrum-run state government of Württemberg a week earlier, a speech whose radio transmission, to Hitler's fury, had been abruptly ended when unknown persons severed the radio cable. Hitler had no need to involve himself in the violence of February 1933. Its deployment could be left safely to Goering and to leading Nazis in other states. In any case, it needed only the green light to Nazi thugs, sure now of the protection of the state, to unleash their pent-up aggression against those well-known to them as long-standing enemies in their neighborhoods and workplaces. The terror wave in Prussia in February was the first sign that state-imposed constraints on inhumanity were now suddenly lifted. It was an early indicator of the breach of civilization that would give the Third Reich its historical character. But it was not that the brutality and violence damaged Hitler's reputation in the population. Many who had been initially skeptical or critical were beginning during February to think that Hitler was the right man and should be given a chance. A slight upturn in the economy helped, but the fervent anti-Marxism of much of the population was more important. The long-standing hatred of socialism and communism, both bracketed together as Marxism, was played upon by Nazi propaganda and turned into outright anti-communist paranoia. Pumped up by the Nazis, fear of a communist rising was in the air. The closer the election came, the shriller grew the hysteria. The full-scale assault on the left was therefore sure of massive popular support. One characteristic report from a Catholic area, where Marxists were seen as the enemies of religion, order, and the nation, lauded the strong-arm tactics in Prussia and gave direct credit for them to Hitler himself. Hitler's clearing up nicely in Prussia. He's throwing the parasites and sponges on the people straight out on their ear. He should follow it up in Bavaria, too, especially in Munich, and carry out a similar purge. If Hitler carries on the work as he has done so far, he'll have the trust of the great proportion of the German people at the coming Reichstag election. The violence and intimidation would probably have continued in much the same vein until the election on the 5th of March. Nothing suggests the Nazi leadership had anything more spectacular in mind. But on the 27th of February, Marinus van der Lubbe set fire to the Reichstag. Marinus van der Lubbe came from a Dutch working-class family and had formerly belonged to the Communist Party youth organization in Holland. He had eventually broken with the Communist Party in 1931. He arrived in Berlin on the 18th of February 1933. He was 24 years old, intelligent, a solitary individual, unconnected with any political groups, but possessed of a strong sense of injustice at the misery of the working class at the hands of the capitalist system. In particular, he was determined to make a lone and spectacular act of defiant protest at the government of national concentration in order to galvanize the working class into struggle against their repression. Three attempts at arson on the 25th of February in different buildings in Berlin failed. 2 days later, he succeeded in his protest, though the consequences were scarcely those he had envisaged. On the evening of the 27th of February, Putzi Hanfstengel should have been dining at Goebbels's house along with Hitler, but suffering from a heavy cold and high temperature, he had taken to his bed in a room in Göring's official residence where he was temporarily accommodated, in the immediate vicinity of the Reichstag building. In mid-evening he was awakened by the cries of the housekeeper. The Reichstag was on fire. He shot out of bed, looked out of the window, saw the building in flames, and immediately rushed to ring up Goebbels, saying breathlessly that he urgently had to speak to Hitler. When Goebbels asked what it was about and whether he could pass on a message, Hanfstengel said, "Tell him the Reichstag is burning." "Is that meant to be a joke?" was Goebbels's reply. Goebbels thought it was a mad fantasy report and refused at first to tell Hitler. But his inquiries revealed that the report was true. At that, Hitler and Goebbels raced through Berlin to find Göring already on the scene and in full flow, ganz groß in Fahrt. Papen soon joined them. The Nazi leaders were all convinced that the fire was a signal for a communist uprising, a last attempt, as Goebbels put it, through fire and terror, to sow confusion in order in the general panic to grasp power for themselves. Fears that the communists would not remain passive, that they would undertake some major show of force before the election, had been rife among the Nazi leadership and among non-Nazi members of the national government. A police raid on the KPD's central offices in Karl Liebknecht House on the 24th of February had intensified anxieties. Though they actually found nothing of note, the police claimed to have found vast amounts of treasonable material, including leaflets summoning the population to armed revolt. Göring added to this with a statement to the press. "The police discoveries showed that Germany was about to be cast into the chaos of Bolshevism," he alleged. "Assassinations of political leaders, attacks on public buildings, and the murder of wives and families of public figures were among the horrors he evoked." No evidence was ever made public. The fears, genuine and fabricated, were in some ways a direct continuation of the anxieties about a communist-led general strike that had been the basis of the Reichswehr's war games scenario, which had brought down the Papen government at the beginning of December 1932. They were also fueled by Hitler's lasting phobia about November 1918. The anti-communist hysteria of late February 1933 gave such fears an altogether sharper edge. The panic reaction of the Nazi leadership to the Reichstag fire, and the rapidity with which the draconian measures against the communists were improvised, derived directly from those fears. The first members of the police to interrogate van der Lubbe, who had been immediately apprehended and had straightaway confessed, proclaiming his protest, had no doubt that he had set fire to the building alone, that no one else was implicated. But Göring, whose first reactions to learning of the fire appear to have been concern for the precious tapestries in the building, took little convincing from officials on the spot that the fire must have been the product of a communist plot. Hitler, who arrived towards 10:30 p.m., an hour or so after Göring, was rapidly persuaded to draw the same conclusion. Göring told him that the fire was unquestionably the work of the communists. One arsonist had already been arrested, and several communist deputies had been in the building only minutes before the blaze. "It was the beginning of the communist uprising," claimed Göring. "Not a moment must be lost." Hitler told Papen, "This is a God-given signal, Herr Vice-Chancellor. If this fire, as I believe, is the work of the communists, then we must crush out this murderous pest with an iron fist." When Rudolf Diels, later to become the first head of the Prussian Gestapo, tried to tell Hitler about the interrogation of van der Lubbe, he found the Reich Chancellor in a near hysterical state. Diels tried to say that the fire was the work of a madman, einen Verrückten. But Hitler brusquely interrupted, shouting that it had been planned long in advance. The communist deputies were to be hanged that very night, he raged. Nor was any mercy to be shown to the Social Democrats or Reichsbanner. Hitler's furious tirades, intent on terroristic revenge against the communists, dominated a hastily convened consultation involving Göring, Goebbels and Frick in Göring's official residence. Good actor though he was, Hitler was not feigning, nor was he sufficiently in control of himself to give clear orders. It was Göring who emitted a frenzied stream of confused directions to Diels, ordering a full-scale police alert, unsparing use of firearms, and mass arrests of communists and socialists. Diels thought the whole atmosphere resembled that of a madhouse. Hitler then went to an improvised meeting around 11:15 p.m. in the Prussian Ministry of the Interior, dealing mainly with security implications for Prussia, and from there accompanied Goebbels to the Berlin offices of the Völkische Beobachter, where an inflammatory editorial was rapidly prepared and a new front page of the party newspaper made up. At the meeting in the Prussian Ministry of the Interior, it was the German National State Secretary Ludwig Grauert, firmly convinced himself that the communist had set the Reichstag alight, who proposed an emergency decree for the state of Prussia aimed at arson and acts of terror. By the following morning, however, Reich Minister of the Interior Wilhelm Frick had come up with the draft of a decree for the protection of people and state, which extended the emergency measures to the whole of the Reich, something attributed by Blomberg to Hitler's presence of mind, and gave the Reich government, in the initial draft it was the Reich Minister of the Interior, powers of intervention in the Länder. Frick could use, as his basis, draft schemes for a state of emergency prepared at the time of the Papen coup against Prussia the previous July, and the war games of Colonel Ott in December. But a crucial difference was that under Frick's draft decree, emergency executive power was placed not in the hands of the Reichswehr, but given to the Reich Minister of the Interior, later altered to the Reich government. A military state of emergency would have limited Hitler's power. It might also have jeopardized the holding of the elections on which the Chancellor was relying. As it was, with one move, the improvised emergency decree had decisively strengthened Hitler's hand. The road to dictatorship was now wide open. The emergency decree for the protection of people and state was the last item dealt with by the Cabinet at its meeting on the morning of the 28th of February. With one brief paragraph, the personal liberties enshrined in the Weimar Constitution, including freedom of speech, of association and of the press, and privacy of postal and telephone communications, were suspended indefinitely. With another brief paragraph, the autonomy of the Länder was overridden by the right of the Reich government to intervene to restore order. This right would be made ample use of in the immediate aftermath of the election to ensure Nazi control throughout all the German states. The hastily constructed emergency decree amounted to the Charter of the Third Reich. By the time of the cabinet meeting, Hitler's near-hysterical mood of the previous evening had given way to colder ruthlessness. The psychologically correct moment for the showdown with the KPD had arrived. It was pointless to wait longer, he told the cabinet. The struggle against the communists should not be dependent on juristical considerations. There was no likelihood that this would be the case. The rounding up of communist deputies and functionaries had already been set in train by Göring during the night in raids carried out with massive brutality. Communists were the main targets, but social democrats, trade unionists, and left-wing intellectuals such as Karl Ossietzky were also among those dragged into improvised prisons, often in the cellars of SA or SS local headquarters, and savagely beaten, tortured, and in some cases murdered. By April, the number taken into protective custody in Prussia alone was some 25,000. The violence and repression were widely popular. The emergency decree that took away all personal liberties and established the platform for dictatorship was warmly welcomed. A provincial newspaper from the Alpine outreaches of Bavaria though long sympathetic towards the Nazis, almost certainly reflecting feelings extending beyond the immediate support for the NSDAP, declared that the emergency decree had finally got to the center of the German disease, the ulcer which had for years poisoned and infected the German blood, Bolshevism, the deadly enemy of Germany. This emergency decree will find no opponent, despite the quite draconian measures which it threatens. Against murderers, arsonists, and poisoners, there can only be the most rigorous defense. Against terror, the reckoning through the death penalty. The fanatics who would like to make a robber's cave out of Germany must be rendered harmless. The whole of Western culture, resting on Christianity, was at stake, the leading article concluded. And for this reason, we welcome the recent emergency decree. The tone directly reflected Goering's account of the supposed findings in the Karl Liebknecht House. From the other end of the country, the Hamburg former schoolteacher, Luise Solmitz, also swallowed Goering's story in its entirety. They wanted to send armed gangs into the villages to murder and start fires. Meanwhile, the terror was to take over the large cities, stripped of their police. Poison, boiling water, all tools from the most refined to the most primitive were to be used as weapons. It sounds like a robber's tale if it were not Russia that had experienced Asiatic methods and orgies of torture that a Germanic mind, even if sick, cannot imagine, and if healthy, cannot believe. Luise Solmitz, like her friends and neighbors, was persuaded to cast her vote for Hitler. Now it's important to support what he's doing with every means. An acquaintance who had up to then not supported the NSDAP told her. The entire thoughts and feelings of most Germans are dominated by Hitler, Frau Solmitz commented. His fame rises to the stars. He is the savior of a wicked, sad German world. On the 4th of March, Hitler made a final, impassioned plea to the electorate in a speech broadcast from Königsberg. At the end, he stated with great pathos that the Reich President, the liberator of East Prussia, and he, the ordinary soldier who had done his duty on the Western Front, had joined hands. As the speech ended, the sounds of the Niederländisches Dankgebet, the chorale of Leuten, associated with Frederick the Great's victory over the Austrians in 1757, blended with the bells of Königsberg Cathedral. Goebbels had left nothing out in the suggested uniting of the old and the new Germany. Loudspeakers stationed in the streets allowed those marching in the torch-like processions all over Germany on the day of the awakening nation to listen to their leader. When the results were declared the next day, the Nazis had won 43.9% of the vote, giving them 288 out of 647 seats in the new Reichstag. Their nationalist coalition partners had gained 8.0%. Despite the draconian terror, the KPD had still managed an astonishing 12.3%, and the SPD 18.3%, together the parties of the left, even now, gaining almost a third of all votes cast. The Zentrum received only a marginally smaller proportion of the vote, 11.2%, than it had done the previous November. Support for the remaining parties had dwindled almost to nothing. Goebbels claimed the result as a glorious triumph. It was rather less than that. Substantial gains had been certain. They had undoubtedly been assisted by a late surge following the Reichstag fire. Hitler had hoped for an absolute majority for the NSDAP. As it was, the absolute majority narrowly attained by the government coalition left him dependent on his conservative allies. He would now not be rid of them at least as long as Hindenburg lived, he was reported as saying on hearing the results. Still, even allowing for the climate of intense repression against the left, 43.9% of the vote was not easy to attain under the Weimar electoral system. The NSDAP had profited above all from the support of previous non-voters in a record turnout of 88.8%. And though the heaviest support continued to come from Protestant parts of the country, sizable gains had this time also been made in Catholic areas, which the NSDAP had earlier found difficult to penetrate. In Lower Bavaria, for instance, the Nazi vote rose from 18.5% in November 1932 to 39.2%. In Cologne-Aachen, from 17.4% to 30.1%. Not least, leaving aside the left, not all those who voted for parties other than the NSDAP were opposed to everything that Hitler stood for. Once Hitler, the pluralist system liquidated, was able to transform his public image from party to national leader,